Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Wangba. Today we're going to be discussing the hidden toxins in hair extension and the health implication for particularly Black women. I'm joined by two special guests, Dr. Adanna Lanos, Associate Professor at the Department of Epidemiology at the Herbert Ivin Comprehensive Cancer Center at Columbia University. And I'm also joined by Dr. Alicia Franklin, who is a research scientist at Silent Spring Institute. Ladies, it's a pleasure to have you join me today, and I look forward to a wonderful conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I'm grateful. Great. To be on the platform.
Great. Let me start from Alicia. Alicia, your institute, and I'm sure you're part of them, did a very report or study in February where the highlight is hair extensions contain, you know, more dangerous chemicals than previously known. Can you run us through the process? Let's start first from the process. How did you come to this, you know, damning conclusion? What is the process and how is it well taken?
Yeah, so this study started just as an exploration of the chemicals that were in hair extensions. We really wanted to just get a comprehensive understanding. So we did what is called like a non-targeted analysis. And as you would imagine, based on the name, is you are not specifying the particular chemicals that you want to identify, but instead you are saying, hey, I just want to know everything that's in these hair extensions. And we tested 43 hair extension products that we purchased at a local beauty supply store and also online. And what we found was we were able to detect about 900 chemicals across these hair extensions. And of the 900 that we could actually detect so that we know are in this product, there were only a handful of those or a small portion of those we could. It was 169 chemicals that we actually identify, which means that there is a larger portion of those chemicals that we actually don't know what they are, or these compounds where we are not able to identify them. But of that 169 chemicals that we did identify, we ended up finding that there were a few dozen of those that were chemicals of health concern. These include chemicals that disrupt your hormones. These are carcinogens, developmental toxicants, just chemicals that are associated with different adverse health outcomes.
Let me stay with you for a second. So you mentioned non-targeted approach to it and the hair extension. So I want to say, you know, sometimes in research, you're looking at credibility, how, you know, looking at the scope of the products in this instance that you've tested and see, can we make a generalization based from that? So when you say non-targeted, I say in random selections, can you speak more to that and how credible that is? Does that also affect the validity of that, you know, that generalization?
So can you ask me that in a different way?
Okay, I'll say it a different way. So what I'm saying is, so do you think the product you tested is enough in terms of quantity I don't know if this is qualitative a study.
It's more qualitative in nature.
Yeah, it seems that it's more qualitative in
nature. It's more semi-quantitative, so we can compare across samples. Like this sample may have more of this chemical, that sample may have less of it, but it doesn't necessarily give us the exact quantity in like for something like a regulation, right? So if there's a regulation that says this chemical needs to be below this certain concentration, we don't have that information, but we can say this sample versus that sample does have these differences in concentrations.
Let me come to you. So even for such, I don't know if it's a small quantity or a large quantity, to have that amount of toxic in it, is quite one that is very important. So how does that speak to so now are we just scratching the surface if we've not even tested many things? So how is this, does it give warning? Should we be alarmed that we're going to do more testing?
Yeah, we know that our exposures are cumulative. And so and we also know that a lot of like hormone disruptors, for example, can cause harm at low concentrations. And so it's not that, you should be thinking about, it's just this little amount, because, you know, when you think about the fact that some of these chemicals are already in other products that we're using. So it's just adding up on our cumulative exposure. We're also talking about products that are disproportionately used by an already overburdened population of people, which are Black women. So Black women are using these at higher rates and more often than other groups of women. And so studies have shown that we already have higher levels of some of these consumer product chemicals in our bodies. And so we really want to start addressing like what are some of the sources to those exposures. And what this speaks to is these are potential sources of exposure. We know that hair extensions are chronic. If these chemicals are in these products and we're using them constantly, I know when I get braids, for an example, I don't take my braids out at night and then put them back in the morning. You know, I wear my braids for months at a time sometimes. And so if the chemicals are being leached from the hair, that's a chronic exposure to a product. And so it is something that we should just think about when we're considering our risk and some of the, our cumulative or overall exposures to certain chemicals.
Yeah, Adana, let me come to you. So in your study, looking at the causes of cancer, so in this study of over 900 chemicals, I think about 169 was identified to have distinct chemicals that causes cancer. How significant is this number? What are those particular chemicals and how significant is it?
So I won't speak specifically to the chemicals because Dr. Franklin is our analytical chemist on the, on the podcast.
I should have been asking that, isn't it?
Yes. But anyway. What I would say is that this is cause for alarm. Not alarm in the sense that women should just stop braiding their hair or stop, doing these behaviors that are a part of our culture, a part of our identity. But what I think this, Dr. Franklin's study has shown is basically that we need to be a little more aware of the potential exposures that we're exposing ourselves to doing routine things like getting our hair braided, right? As Dr. Franklin mentioned, when Black women get braids, myself included, I'm keeping the braids for about 2 months. So I'm sleeping on the braids. The braids are on my skin, on my scalp. And so any chemicals in these products are potentially being absorbed through our bodies dermally, fumes, through inhalation. So the truth is we really don't have a lot of research focused on this topic, despite the evidence that we know Black women use these products and many other equally toxic product in combination, right? So thinking about cumulative exposures, the braiding hair is just one source of exposure to these toxic chemicals, like endocrine disrupting chemicals. But we use so many products. If we just focus on hair products alone, Black women are the highest consumers per capita of hair products. And when you dive deeper into the chemicals in these hair products, you find that they contain toxic ingredients. And these are the products that are marketed to and used by Black women. So this is something that we're basically just scratching the surface here.
So let me still stay with you. You mentioned, you know, like Riley said, and Alicia mentioned it as well, overwhelmingly Black people are the ones using this product. And I like the way you said it. Black women are the highest consumer using this product. But you also mentioned something about culture and identity. So I wanted to ask, what culture and identity are you referring to here when you say culture and identity?
So I would say that as a Black woman, and I'm speaking as a Black woman, right? Like my hair is a part of my identity. Because of the uniqueness of being Black, I can wear my hair 1,000 different ways in a year if I chose to. I can wear braids. I can wear extensions. I can have my natural hair out. It can be straightened. It can be, you know, in its coily, curly state. We have the prerogative to wear our hair any way we want. And it really is a reflection of who we are and where we come from. And I would say braids is a part of our cultural identity, right? Like it's an art form, if you think about it, from the African continent. And many of us in the Western world, like we also appreciate that, that form of sharing our identity through our hair.
You could add to it, yeah.
Yeah, and I'd like to highlight that we didn't only test braiding hair, we also tested human hair extensions as well, and eyelashes as well, which are more, I would say, cosmetic in nature than like, you know, a hair, you know, hairstyle. But the human hair the human hair extensions, so the ones that are usually used for wefting, had more higher number of these chemicals that are associated with harm in them than some of the synthetic braiding hair products. So it's not just the products that we use as a, you know, for the braiding and for, you know, cultural identity and things like that, but also the ones we're using for convenience. I say some people may do like sew-ins or make a wig out of convenience. And like, I just want something that I can put in. I don't have to worry about my hair for a little while. And it's easy to do, easy to upkeep. And so there's also that angle too, where it's like, it's any style that you're using where you're adding extensions, there's that potential exposure to these chemicals.
So speaking of the dynamics in terms of, I think Adana might be able to answer this question. So looking at how the cost is, you're looking at the disparity in race, looking at how, you know, tracking or tracing causes of cancer. So if Alyssa said they also tested eyelashes, I think eyelashes is more generally used, I don't know if I'm wrong, correct me, it's more generally used maybe with the whites as well. So I don't know, have you seen any differentiation in terms of how this might cause cancer? Or did you find any toxic in the eyelashes compared to the human hair extension? Were there any kind of like distinction or whatever?
No, the chemicals that we found in the lashes were also found in the hair extension. So it's, there, as far as like the different types of toxicants we found, like we did identify like chemicals that are associated with breast cancer outcomes as well in these products.
So Adana, do you in your work tracking the causes and all of that, what can you speak to the disparity in terms of race? Let's say a white woman and a Black woman, in terms of cancer now, for instance, and how this might lead to it.
So one of the things that I mentioned earlier is that, you know, there haven't been very many studies on these topics yet, right? Mm-hmm. So So these new studies, including some of our work, Dr. Franklin and I focusing on chemical relaxers, really are just now scratching the surface, right? And the intention of this work is to start to understand, well, what might be some of the unique exposures that Black women might have compared to other racial and ethnic groups that could explain some of the differences, some of the disparities that we see in breast cancer incidence and outcomes. As you know, Black women are diagnosed at younger ages than other racial and ethnic groups, and we tend to be diagnosed with more aggressive tumors. And so, you know, just thinking about the increasing incidence of early onset breast cancer, this is sort of the impetus for why I was so interested in studying novel exposures, you know, exposures that have not yet been studied, because clearly there's something we're exposed to that has not yet been linked to cancer outcomes. And just realizing that we use so many products, especially hair products. Like, I keep coming back to hair products just because, I mean, I use a lot of hair products. I've been very careful in hair products that I've selected. And I talk to friends and family and colleagues about this topic a lot. But if we even just, you know, set aside hair products, we use so many personal care products or cosmetics on our bodies every single day. And as Dr. Franklin mentioned, these, any exposure or any chemical that we're exposed to through these products, the doses may be small, but they accumulate over time. So if you think about using a product that has high concentrations of endocrine disrupting chemicals, whether you're a female or male, those exposures after using the product every day for years accumulates and can be damaging to your cells and your tissues. And to the
Go on. Yeah, you mentioned something before, and you've also kind of like illustrated that in your own behavior as well. You mentioned something about awareness, and then you said in choosing your own products, you're careful. This is your way. You're careful the hair products that you choose. So I wanted to ask that because in Elisa, you guys concluded in your research there should be some sort of regulation. And stuff like that. So regulation and awareness. Well, so from what Dr. Lennox is saying now, it's more like people have to be aware, people need to be conscious, maybe education, people need to know what a man this in selecting the product. We also talk about regulation. How do we marry these two?
So I believe that until there's regulation, there needs to be awareness. So I do not believe where we are now as a society is that people need to be aware because there aren't any regulations. Whereas like if the regulations did exist, then we would already have a safer chemical landscape in our across countries and across the world, right? So regulations can be put in place because it can protect everyone, because these chemicals would not be allowed in our products. They would be required to be tested for safety before they're actually put in products. And like folks could just live frivolously and like not have to think about it. But because we aren't there yet and chemicals are allowed to be put in products before they're tested for safety, we have to just be more aware as individuals, which, you know, it's one of those things that could be useful for more upstream impact. So again, using your buying power to lead to maybe your favorite store no longer selling certain products. So it could also be shopping at stores where they're only selling products that have certain products, which that's not sustainable, you know, not sustainable, but it's like, yeah, using your buying power, because like Dr. Yonos mentioned, it's like we are the ones purchasing these products at way more than any other group of people. But we all decided that, you know what, we will no longer allow companies to continue to sell us products that they know could cause us harm, they would think about it and figure out how to create a safer formula for us to purchase.
So I think that the solution is multi-pronged, right? The first thing I'll say is consumers should not need to have a degree in chemistry to understand which products are safer than others, right? But overall, I think awareness is our first step, because as Dr. Franklin mentioned, through awareness, we can begin to make more informed decisions about the brands that we purchase. If we know that certain brands are intentional about making cleaner, safer products that we use, then we might spend our money there. But awareness is just sort of the first step as we continue to generate this data. But in addition, we need interventions at the retail level, at the manufacturing level, at the policy level. So this really is a multi-level, you know, intervention that is needed. And I think over time, we can get there, but a lot of sectors have to come to the table to make sure that products that are marketed to and used by an already vulnerable group are better.
You could just ask and say, why is there no regulation so far? And what is the level of activism to get regulation, or why?
So in the US, regulations are minimal. In the UK and in the EU, rather, there appears to be much more regulation of chemicals in consumer products. And without going too deep into what exists, you know, in certain places and what doesn't exist in other places, you know, the real question is, why have some nations decided to emphasize safety around chemicals and prohibit certain chemicals from consumer products, including food, and why other countries don't? So there's a disparity right there, right? Policies are different. I can't speak to why certain policies exist in certain places and they don't in others. But these are things to think about, right? So the same brands that sell products in the US have very different regulations to be able to sell their products in the EU.
Elisa, you're going to say something. Sorry for cutting you off.
No, I was just going to add on to what Dr. Janos was saying about you shouldn't need a degree in chemistry to be able to understand your labels. As someone with a PhD in chemistry, I still struggle to try to navigate the chemical landscape, because the one thing that's most challenging is that not only is it you have to understand the chemical on the label, they will give one chemical five different names, and you have to figure out, okay, is this one of the synonyms for this chemical? And you have to navigate in that way. So there's down to the way that the chemicals are listed on the product. It's just challenging, because there should be some common name or something that allows us to be able to navigate labels a little bit better, and it's simply not. So on one label it may say one thing, but on another label it might be synonym for it, and so it's just hard to navigate that space for everyone.
I was gonna ask Elisa, what is the implication of your study outside of the US, because the products you tested were in the US, so would you say it would be the same if you had tested products outside of the US?
Yeah, so there are actually studies that were done in Nigeria where they found heavy metals in braiding hair as well, but they didn't test for the broader chemicals that are in the hair extensions. So, you know, based on what, like, it had been the heavy metals, I assume there's potential for them to have some of those other harmful chemicals in the braiding hair as well. So, but that, again, like Dr. Yanos has mentioned multiple times, it's just this work needs, we need more funding in this work. There needs to be more emphasis on understanding what are in the products we're using. And a lot of the products that we actually purchased were manufactured abroad. So they were manufactured in other countries. We don't know where they're being exported and imported to. So I know that they were at the stores that we visited, and a lot of them were actually manufactured in Asia, some country in Asia. So whether that be China, Japan, some other country. So I'm pretty sure that they're manufacturing there and potentially shipping out to wherever the demand is.
And what I was going to ask Adana is a question that is maybe kind of like general as well, to say it is quite a paradox that a product that is used overwhelmingly by the Black population, whether in America, whether in Africa, is being produced, as Alicia said, by people outside of the continent, people of the different ethnicities that might not understand some of the composition of the Black. Why is that so? And why is the Black populace, Black scientists, not taking agency or ownership or trying to find something that for themselves, something that helps them for themselves? Is it a finance issue? What is it?
I'm not totally sure, but I think that's how it's been for decades. If you think about beauty supply stores in Black neighborhoods, who owns them? Mm-hmm. The majority of them are owned by Asian individuals, right? So what has driven that and driven their manufacturing of products for Black people, I have no idea. But I will say there are some Black beauty brands, including braiding hair, that have recently come on the market that are that are focused on making less toxic braiding hair. There are brands that are now making braiding hair from banana fibers and different things, right? So there is innovation among Black scientists and Black owners and manufacturers. So I think as more of this evidence is showing scientifically that there are differences and there are causes for alarm and causes for us to really think about the products that we purchase and the products that we use on a regular basis, there will be an increasing demand for safer alternatives. And hopefully those safer alternatives will be at price points that make them accessible. And hopefully people will gravitate towards those brands and those products.
Let me, same question, but in a different way, Lisa, I'm going to ask you. So even here in the UK, when you say you're going to an African store, I'm always quite bedazzled with how it's Asian owned. And I'm like, how is it called an African store? Because it sells African product, but it's owned by Asians. So if we continue and say, now, when these Asian stores or Asian manufacturers produce this stuff, do you think there is it from not knowing what might be suitable for the Black populace? Or do you think that there's a bit of knowledge or not caring, whatever implication it might do? So is it from either of this perspective, or which perspective is it from?
Yeah, that we don't know. I will say that the chemicals that we identify, a lot of them are legacy chemicals. And so I don't know that it's we don't know, or we produced this product back in the early 90s and it works. People keep buying it, so we're going to keep making it. So there is no push to actually make any changes because there hasn't been a demand for that change. So I don't know about whether they became aware or, you know, whatever's going on behind the scenes. But some of these chemicals are just chemicals that have been historically used in plastics. And we know that hair extensions is, or braiding hair in particular, synthetic braiding hair is a type of plastic, a type of single-use plastic. You use it, you throw it away, but you're done. And so the chemicals we're finding are just have been found in so many different products. And so I think now with us being more aware and us finding some of these legacy chemicals in the products, we can, and we're calling them out, there may be now that push to say, okay, we need to consider how can we reformulate, because people are moving away from our product and to those safer options.
So then let me ask you, following up what Alisa said, so could it be a question where there might be, because we've seen also in, is it the Johnson powder that's going on there it's come out that it's caused a lot of cancer to babies that have been using Johnson powder for years. Do you think there might be a case or point where there might be litigation, where the black people might want to hold these companies accountable? Or is it just, as Alicia suggested, it's just walking away from them, working to try and make them lose money? Which one do you think which option do you think might happen or might be more effective in creating the change needed?
I think both options are possible. You know, currently there are litigations against makers of chemical hair relaxers, alleging that the use of these products cause uterine cancers and other reproductive related conditions, which again, have much higher incidence and poor outcomes in Black women. So there's definitely the possibility, as we generate more scientific evidence showing that these products could potentially be harmful because they contain carcinogens and other toxic chemicals linked to adverse health outcomes. I'll add that, you know, as scientists, we typically end many of our reports with a statement, more research is needed. My question is, when is enough research available to say now is time to act? I'll add one last point, and that is we need more research in the sense that some people will say, well, yeah, you found these chemicals in these products, but how do we know that they're causing or linked to increased risk of any outcome? Well, until we're able to do those studies and design those studies to generate credible evidence, all we can do is rely on the evidence that has shown for decades that these are carcinogens, these are toxic chemicals, they're linked to health harms, right? So when is enough evidence enough? I don't have that answer. But I do think that, you know, this is important research, and people will start to understand that we do really need to think about the products that we're using, because we really are exposing ourselves to many things unintentionally.
And Alisa, do you have the answer? Adam is saying, on one hand, when do we say that we've had enough research? But on the other hand, you're also saying this particular is under researched. So yeah, what are we saying? How do you resolve, reconcile that paradox?
Well, I'll say this. I think that I'm a firm believer that chemicals should not be put on the market until they've been studied. So when we talk about under versus over, I think that there's enough evidence for some chemicals to say that we know that this chemical is associated with harm, and we probably shouldn't be adding this to the products that we're using every day. And so until then there are chemicals that we just have absolutely no knowledge of. And so I think that there is enough evidence for some chemicals, and then there's not enough for others. So there's that. But I also wanted to add that the work itself, I think the reason why, when it comes to hair products in particular and products that are mostly used in the Black community or Black communities, it's behind is because a lot of this work is not informed by the people in the communities that actually are living, have these lived experiences. So I think it's also important in thinking about how to do this research that you're actually engaging with, and it's being led by the folks that actually are impacted by these studies as well. So it's not just about finding someone who has the money to do it, but, you know, making sure you're uplifting the scientists and the people in the community that actually have the lived experience to be able to help to guide what the research question should be, and, you know, what what's feasible and what is something that is sustainable long term that can actually make an impact.
I'm going to ask both of you the same question, but let me start with Adana. So I'm going to go back to the question of identity and culture, and look at us black people and black women. Look at the history of let's go way back to the history of wearing human hair, and other than say, where did it come from? And is that natural to the black woman? And why is there, more at least to say, why is there no that kind of like intense interest among the same community that you're fighting for to be leading this kind of research? And is that really our identity? Is there an identity crisis here where again, people might look at it, a lot of people would have looked at it from a question of trying to be more European or whatever it is. How do you navigate that, all of these complexities where you're looking at, you know, this is my choice, and people are looking at it, but, you know, again, looking at the origin, and this is more European. You talked about, before we started, Adana and I talked about lightning cream as well, which is quite prevalent in Africa, where people want to bleach that cream. So would you say this is identity, this is a choice, or is it also some sort of colonial heritage, or looking, trying to mirror or be like someone other than what you are naturally? So how do we deal with all of that?
Yes, this is a question that we grapple with a lot doing this work. So I have a few thoughts on this. The first is that a lot of what is viewed as beautiful is or has been grounded in Eurocentric beauty ideals, which, you know, obviously is tied to colonialism and racism. So that is also in the background, right, of what we're talking about, the products that we're using, whether we wear our hair straight, whether we get relaxers, whether we use skin lightening or bleaching creams to make our skin lighter. So I'll say, on one hand, yes, hair is an identity, a part of the identity of Black women. And again, the beauty of being a Black woman is that my hair can do many different things. I can wear it straight. I can wear it curly. As I've already mentioned, braids, extensions, wigs, whatever it is, however I'm feeling that day, I can wear my hair that way. But I will say that some people don't have the privilege of doing that, right? Depending on the industry that they're working in. For instance, I'm just using this as an example. And there are... there's evidence to suggest that, you know, straighter hair and lighter skin is associated with more privilege, socioeconomic privilege, you know, job security, and things of that nature. We can't exclude that fact. We have to consider the sociopolitical context in which people live. You know, the natural hair movement was a thing where many women stopped relaxing their hair and, you know, they wore their hair in the natural state. I mean, I wear my hair in the natural state because I don't get relaxers. Does that mean that I always wear my hair curly or kinky or whatever? No, I flop and decide on the day, right? Again, I have that prerogative. I have the privilege to do that. But I think that this question is really important. You know, we think about personal care products and consumer products as just about choice. Like, we are choosing to use these products every day. But I think it's not just about choice, right? Because as I mentioned, some people, they feel pressure to present themselves a certain way. And Black people are the only group that I feel like has that sort of pressure, right? And so when we think about just, oh, well, this person is straightening their hair or getting their hair relaxed because they want to look like a European, I don't think that that's necessarily the case. And so another question is, well, why do women wear their hair in the way that they wear their hair? Why do women, you know, choose to present themselves to the world in the way that they do? And that is a choice for sure. But I think that there are also other nuances that we're not addressing when we just think about, you know, the texture of our hair, right? Going to the skin lightening creams. Well, I think that, again, colonialism is why people choose to use these products that are harmful, right, to our health in many different ways, to have lighter skin. Because again, lighter skin and straighter hair has been associated with privilege in different ways. So I think I say all that to say we can't just focus on, you know, assuming that the reason that people are doing what they're doing or presenting themselves is only because they look like a Eurocentric person, right? There's more to it than that. And I think that especially in places like America and the UK, there may be a lot more to the issue.
Alyssa, what do you think? And how can the Black woman in particular, the Black people, how can a Black woman reclaim, maintain agency and reclaim its identity? And like Adana said, which I really appreciate, you can choose to do what you want to do. You could choose on a given day. But then again, we can also shy away from why. You've mentioned why a lot of white people do this. How do we deal with that why and reclaim identity and agency?
Yeah, I think that the choosing your hair, whatever hairstyle you want, is your, you know, agency, and you're doing it because it's something that is true to, you know, how you're feeling and how, like, again, like Dana said, depending on how I'm feeling, my hair is going to look a different way. So I'm a firm believer that a large reason why Black women in particular choose hairstyles, especially Black women, people in certain professions, is out of convenience, being able to wake up every morning, being able to say, okay, this, I can predict how my hair is going to look in the morning. As someone who has worn wigs, sew-ins, braids, you kind of know that these styles are things you can depend on when you wake up in the morning. I can go straight to work and I'm not going to have no fuss from my hair. Whereas when I more so wear my natural hair, we can just say it, like, there is a particular expectation of Black women when they wear their natural hair. Black women, if we choose to wear our hair kinky, curly, as it grows out of our head, there's a certain want from not the white folks that we work with, but our Black colleagues, that our hair should look a certain way when it's coily or curly. And so when I wear my natural hair and it's not to the T that the or to the expectations of my Black colleagues, there is a, you know, there's this expectation as well. And so I do firmly believe that the styles, it's not only about like wanting to appeal to some Eurocentric beauty, but actually wanting to, you know, more so have make our fellow sister and brethren proud as well. And so, I feel like we all.
I'm proud of your hair. I like the way you wear it.
We have this burden. Like, we have this burden where I feel like Black, and especially in the US, we feel like we represent our community. Some people get to live as an individual, and when they make decisions, it is a decision that they made. And that does not represent them, or that does not represent their people, that does not represent their family. This is a sole decision of an individual, whereas as a Black person, it's like when you make a decision or you look a certain way, it's like, oh, see, like, and you're a representation of the whole culture, like every culture across the world that is, you know, Black identified. And so I do think that we are sometimes even more critical of each other than others are of us.
I agree with you. And before I ask the last question, I'm just going to make an analogy. So there is, both of them are dead now. They are literally giants. One is from Kenya, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, and Chinua Achebe. And they just decided, you know, Atiogo just decided to say, no, I'm writing in the language of the colonial masters. I don't want to write in the language again. But I think it changes it. But Achebe said, listen, I've received this language. I'm going to make it mine. So right in a way, man. So I now understand what you're talking about. Yes, this is it, but I'm gonna wear it in my own way. I'm making mine, and then that way you've taken back control, taken back. So I really appreciate that. So last question to both of you: what is the solution in the midterm, in the medium term, and the long term?
I'll start. I think the solution is to continue doing this work. Right? As Black women, we are leaders in this field. We have the lived experience. We use the products. We sort of understand some of the explanations behind why we're using these products. But this work coming from, you know, and being led by Black women in collaboration with community partners, we are leading and paving the way to really understanding why certain products marketed to us, used by us, are more harmful. In addition, we also can lead the way in, you know, elevating brands and manufacturers of products made for us that are better, you know, safer, less toxic, containing less chemicals of concern. So in the meantime, you know, we just need to continue doing this work and continue spreading the information, spreading the awareness, and hopefully this will drive some of the multi-level interventions that I alluded to earlier.
Brilliant. And you, Alicia?
And I believe that, like, along, like with the research, there needs to be more, work to try to get these, hold these companies accountable. And so whatever research can be done to say, hey, like, you should stop adding these chemicals into the products. I really believe that it's the chemical regulation that can really help and make a safer chemical landscape for all. So if there were chemists, for instance, held accountable for understanding what their final chemical product does as far as health outcomes, that in itself would be have so many downstream like effects. So if, for instance, when that chemical is synthesized, it shouldn't just be, oh, it has this functional purpose and it works for non-stick and it works for keeping the hair soft and luscious. Mm-hmm. It should then be a further analysis and required to do further analysis to say, hey, this chemical also isn't associated with reproductive issues. It's not associated with breast cancer. It's not associated. Mm-hmm. And there should be some panel that's required of these scientists before they're allowed to go and take their patented chemical and put it into whatever they want to, because we have a history of putting these chemicals in products and they're innocent until they're proven guilty. And the people who are who are then feeling this and impacted are the most vulnerable folks in the world.
Ladies, I really, really enjoyed this. I'm just going to act like an expert on this and add one suggestion and say, whilst we're doing all that, I think there should be some activism. Some activism and to create that awareness that you mentioned about, and also to create some sort of panel. And in that panel, you have people like yourself that are very expert to be in that panel as well, because it's one thing to create a panel, but it's another thing to have people that are very learned and people that have been affected by this that really understand it from a scientific perspective and also from a consumer perspective to be in that board. But anyways, I'm really grateful to have both of you. I enjoyed, I see your passion, and I'll keep in touch and keep track of your work. And yes, once you do more research, we'll bring you back again. We'll talk about this and see how to promote this. But I really, really appreciate your time. And I say good morning to you, London. Good afternoon, yeah. And thank have a brilliant you. Day. I've enjoyed the rest of your day.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode. It's an interesting episode where we've looked at had the toxins or toxics in there, product extension and health implication for particularly Black women. Join me as usual to thank our guests, Dr. Adanna Linus and Dr. Elisa Franklin. For now, stay blessed and I'll see you next week.